As this podcast contains themes surrounding Indigenous people, we would like to acknowledge that this podcast was recorded on the lands of the Wurundjeri people, who have been custodians of this land for thousands of years. And we would like to acknowledge and pay our respects to their elders past and emerging. As non-Indigenous individuals, we acknowledge that we are talking about Indigenous themes, but have brought an Indigenous expert into the discussion. Furthermore, we would like to forewarn that this episode contains some distressing themes for Indigenous and non-Indigenous individuals. G'day, policy heads. We're back again in episode 5, or 4.2, with Dr. Nikki Moody. We are now discussing about the Indigenous policy in Australia, history of failure and finding reconciliation. In the last episode, we have discussed about the context and the historical background of Indigenous policy in Australia.
So very, very lucky to have Nikki in the studio with us today and to actually break down some still ongoing federal initiatives that have been in place moving forward from the Impology and how we are today. What we've done is we've kind of taken two policies slash strategies that one is quite current in the mainstream media, while the second one may be less attended to, let's just put it that way. So I just wanted to talk briefly with Nikki about the Closing the Gap initiative that was launched in 2008. So at the time, 6 targets were set out to achieve equality for Indigenous Australians in health, education and employment. I will say now, the dates that the targets were set to have been changed, but I'm going to give you the original 2008 just to provide context on the failure of the Closing the Gap initiative.
Yep.
So the targets that were set out originally was to close the life expectancy within a generation by 2031, to halve the gap in mortality rates for Indigenous children under 5 within a decade by 2018, to ensure access to early childhood education for all Indigenous 4-year-olds in remote communities by 2025, to halve the gap in reading, writing and numeracy achievements for children within a decade by 2018, to halve the gap for Indigenous students in year 12 attainment rates by 2020, to halve the gap in employment outcomes between Indigenous and non-Indigenous Australians by 2018, and to lastly close the gap in school attendance by 2018, which was added in 2014. Now, in 2020, only 2 of these targets are rated as on track, and I'll emphasise rated as on track.
Yeah.
So, Nikki, what do you believe the root causes are in terms of policy making that causes such a lack of hitting these targets? Because in 2020, it's quite phenomenal and disgusting, to be frank, that we still haven't reached where we needed to be 2 years ago now.
It's rubbish, isn't
it's
it?
Absolutely. I can't do it.
It's rubbish. The targets are rubbish, though.
Yeah.
You know, I think that what we have to kind of untangle, I'm doing a lot of untangling really in this podcast, aren't I? I kind of want to come back. I want to separate out the Close the Gap campaign, which was actually started out of the health sector by a coalition of organisations, the Aboriginal Doctors Association, Oxfam, Red Cross, a whole bunch of people in the health sector, NGOs kind of got together and were like, 17-year gap life expectancy is horrific. This is a first world country. We should not have a 17-year life expectancy gap between Indigenous and non-Indigenous Australians. We need to fix it. So this Close the Gap campaign was started years before Kevin Rudd launched this new approach in Indigenous affairs. And I think, you know, sometimes the language kind of gets a bit tricky, so I think it's important to distinguish Close the Gap, amazing campaign, really important people, out of health, really trying to work for health equity, you know, and well-being for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. And then when Kevin Rudd comes to power in 2007, within like a month, he had COAG, the Council of Australian Governments, agree to a national Indigenous reform agenda. And one of the things I think we often need to consider in Indigenous affairs is the impact of the 67 referendum, which wasn't to give Aboriginal people the vote, which was firstly to count Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in the census, and then to enable the Commonwealth government to make Indigenous policy. Before 1967, all the states had their own Indigenous policies, and they still do, but the Commonwealth government couldn't. It was constitutionally prevented from making any Commonwealth-level Indigenous affairs. So then we have this kind of like history of federalism, right? To get into the nitty-gritty of it. And we have like this constant disagreement between the states and territories and the Commonwealth government. And what is it, the local government association that also sits on COAG? It's a weird arrangement, right?
Yeah.
But so this is about how our nation is put together. And fundamentally, there is a contest. There's a contest between the states and the Commonwealth government. There always is. So for Kevin Rudd in 2007 to get all the states and territories around the table to agree with the Commonwealth government to do something in Indigenous affairs, oh my God.
That is,
it's remarkable.
Andrews and Scott Morrison at the moment, like butt heads, like no tomorrow.
You're feeling me,
yeah,
right?
Deaths.
Like,
and, you're like, what?
in a super boring political institution kind of analysis of the situation, right? Like understanding how federalism in Australia works, super important to understanding how Indigenous affairs works.
Yeah.
So National Indigenous Reform Agreement, of which Closing the Gap was a part, and it kind of came out of this lobbying by the health sector with all these other things. So it's a complex institutional process of lobbying, campaigning, it's the state, territory governments all kind of getting in on board, COAG agreeing, right? Amazing. And so we have these processes at play, but then they manifest as these targets. And these are the targets that get rolled out in public as something that we either are or are not achieving.
Mm.
And closing a gap seems like a good thing, right? Like,
yeah,
there's a gap. Let's close it.
It's that simple. Yeah.
It's just like, door's open. Let's shut it. We don't want to let a draft in, right?
Yeah.
And so what that means is that we often take for granted that these targets are actually good targets, right? So let's close the gap in school attendance. Actually, particularly in remote areas, school attendance has little to no impact on NAPLAN results. You know what does impact good outcomes for Aboriginal kids in remote communities? Employing local community members in the school in any capacity, as teacher assistants, as teachers, as principals, as groundskeepers, right? So these associations that we take for granted that turning up at school means you'll get good grades actually doesn't hold true when we try to drill into what really counts, what really helps kids do these things. There's this idea that Aboriginal kids in remote communities aren't attending early childhood is just not true, right? And so we have this idea that because these targets have been set out by people who are obviously, you know, they're well-meaning, educated people who want to do the right thing, and they seem like they're obvious. They seem like they're good. They seem like they're things that we should be aiming for. But in actual fact, often these targets are not the things that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people want attended to. So if we compare these Closing the Gap targets that you just talked about to the targets that were included in the Redfern Statement, and even the targets that are now included in the Close the Gap refresh that Ian Anderson and the National Indigenous Affairs Agency has done, they're quite different. These targets don't include anything about child removals. They don't include anything about the Indigenous incarceration rate. They don't include anything about wellbeing and language and the awful state of Aboriginal languages in this country. And so we look at these things and we think that they're good, as opposed to listening to the things that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people say are the gaps that we want closed, right? And so we kind of have a look at them and then it kind of makes sense that they're not closing because they're the wrong things to be measuring, right?
Yeah.
And that lets us, we can ask all sorts of questions about what is a good thing to measure, how do we go about doing it? But the first point is to ask whether or not Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people think these are good targets. Are they good targets anymore? Maybe there'll be better targets in the future. We have to be able to adapt and change to that.
This probably will bring me to my next question in terms of the Closing the Gap policy in 2020. At the start of the last part one of this episode, I mentioned how Scott Morrison believed that we're on track, but then we're moving quite slowly. What the government has made a point of this year is that they're trying to focus on the good things because they believe that the way that is reported actually masks the progress that they're making. To his credit, Ken Wyatt, the Indigenous Affairs Minister, has also said that they're wanting to focus on the good things that they're trying to do.
Everyone wants a good news story.
Yeah. So where do you stand when they're trying to go for a different mode of engaging with the Closing the Gap report this year?
Again, I would, you know, like really strongly encourage people to get out that detector that I mentioned in the last part and think about what is the purpose that Indigenous Affairs is serving here. Is the purpose of it to give the government a good narrative that it can sell as it gears up to the next election? Probably, if you're going to be a little bit cynical about what this is. Is it to justify increasingly intrusive and paternalistic retreat of the welfare state? To say that you can receive some kind of government support, but only if you comply with the conditions of the basics card, for example. And to justify the continued rollout of that to non-Indigenous communities that are doing it tough. Yeah? How could we in good conscience have a good news story when the rate of Indigenous incarceration in this country continues to rise exponentially? What does it say about our political leaders that they want a good news story to tell when things are quite obviously going backwards? Things are not going well. And it's not a deficit conversation to be able to point to something and say, actually, this is getting worse, not better. Is it a politics of distraction to not talk about constitutional recognition and a voice to parliament? Does it serve a particular purpose to have some conversations and not others? I think that if we're to ask Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in this country about the state of race relations, about the state of our welfare systems, about the way that the government treats its most vulnerable people, are we that interested in a good news story, or are we actually interested in, what, a better set of targets? I don't think so. So I don't know. I don't know if that answers your question, Jared.
Well, do
you reckon it's less about the implementation then? The policy itself is not purposely designed for Indigenous communities. So where do we start?
Well, I think that the first place to start is to listen to what Indigenous people are saying and have been saying, where we're often kind of led to believe that it's hard to hear, that we have to, I don't know, spend our lives dedicated to understanding more about Indigenous cultures and communities. But actually, Indigenous experts are being published in a whole range of different media all of the time. It's not hard to find Megan Davis talking about constitutional recognition. It's not hard to find Marcy Langton talking about the state of politics in Australia. It's not hard to hear Ken Wyatt try to manage the incredible complexity, the impossible complexity that he has to manage. It's actually not so far away to hear the kinds of things that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people say about politics in Australia. But where I think we run into the most trouble is that we think that these are unresolvable problems, that we think that there is no possible way that we can come together to find a new way of doing business. And it's just not true. There are so many options available to us, but we have some work to do to get there.
And just before we move on to our next policy initiative, I just wanted to bring it back to Ken Wyatt and Scott Morrison one last time with what they want to do moving forward. Ken Wyatt, for some people who may not know, the first Indigenous man to hold the portfolio for Indigenous Affairs.
Absolutely, first Aboriginal person ever.
It's phenomenal that it's taken this long. So he's come to the portfolio. He's acknowledged the lack of progress in the Closing the Gap strategy. What he has been saying a lot is that he's trying to have a paradigm shift in how we approach Indigenous policy.
There are a couple of key issues that I think we need to wrap our heads around.
Mm.
One, I think, is an idea of super complexity. If we consider the sheer number of Aboriginal nations in Australia and how each of those nations either entreat with each other or have relationships with the state, suddenly you get an incredibly complex political system, right? Or if we're talking about the state negotiating with each Aboriginal nation, how does each Aboriginal nation know that they're not being ripped off by the government, that someone else is not getting rights that they haven't been allocated to? How do we negotiate this? So when governments talk about negotiating with individual communities, there's very much, I think, a divide and conquer kind of mentality that kind of goes, you know, we're much stronger together when people negotiate as teams. I think you can see that unfolding in the Victorian treaty process down here. But I think, again, we kind of have to come back to this idea about questioning really quite strongly what it is that we're actually setting targets about. No one would ever question that improving literacy and numeracy for anyone is a bad idea. Like, no one's saying that these are terrible things. We should absolutely be aiming to close the life expectancy gap. But what this misrecognizes is the direction of the relationship, the causal relationship that actually has an impact on these things. What is it that leads to a global improvement in Indigenous health? What is it that leads to a global increase in, or community-wide perhaps is probably more specific than global, but a universal, a broad-based improvement in outcomes for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people? And we know from case studies around the world that an increase in the quantity of self-determination leads to a direct increase in the quantity of well-being that Indigenous peoples experience. Where Indigenous peoples have authority over matters of state that have been devolved to them, people are more well, people are happier, people live better lives connected to culture and family and community. And that's not surprising, right? And so we can kind of talk about what's a good target to include, what's a rubbish target, what targets have got evidence. But unless we're having a conversation about what does it mean for Indigenous peoples to be recognised as a political entity or entities that have power, decision-making power devolved from the state to those communities, I think we're kind of not having the right conversation. Mm. Yeah, and that's what a treaty is. At its heart, a treaty cedes some power from one entity to another.
Mm.
And perhaps the state can at some point in time consider what kind of power it might cede from itself to Aboriginal people. Maybe it cedes the power for education over Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander, education of languages and cultures, and maybe Aboriginal communities maintain that power. Maybe not. Maybe that's actually too good. It's easier to, you know, try and fix the Australian schooling system, right? But perhaps Aboriginal communities want power over something else. Why can't we have $10 added to every single rates notice that goes out in the Melbourne CBD, and that money gets paid directly to the Wurundjeri Land Council as a form of compensation, pay the rent? Suddenly, sovereign wealth has been restored. We're not talking about compensation anymore. And those communities have the ability to be able to take care of their own communities' health and well-being needs. You know, like, we so often get stuck in this idea about, is this a good target? Is this a good policy? How close are we out of closing it? And what happens when we don't listen to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people is that we close ourselves off to creative responses to policy problems which can't be resolved in the normal way of doing business.
Now, we want to move to the second initiative or strategy that may be a little bit more intricate for listeners and a little bit more under the radar, but I want to talk about it because I think it's important to talk about how the government operates at a bureaucratic level in terms of Indigenous policy. And I believe that it's good to highlight where we can see that Indigenous people are, especially when they're considered stakeholders in policy, left behind or harder for them to interact with how policy is made surrounding them. So I wanted to bring it to the Indigenous Advancement Strategy, which was a strategy implemented by the Abbott government, or announced by the Abbott government in 2014. It's a significant reform in the administration and delivery of services and programs for Indigenous Australians. The federal government streamlined the use of funding applications into five areas from across a number of portfolios, including health and education, into basically five areas, including employment, education, health, culture, and remote Australia strategies. Overall, this strategy was created and intended to streamline efficiency and reduce red tape and duplication for grant funding recipients, increasing flexibility for them, as well as providing evidence-based grant funding to hit the ground and actually deliver results to Indigenous peoples and their communities. However, since the implementation, there's been two audits released by the Australian National Audit Office, who audits Australian policies.
Everything.
Basically everything. They're great. I love their reports. So they were released in 2017 and 2019, respectively, and both have been scathing. They basically highlight that there's little to no consultation with Indigenous stakeholders, and if there was, it still blindsided them upon release. There was no long-term performance indicators implemented, so they actually have no idea as a government what the results really
are. It's almost like they weren't interested in the results, Jared.
Well, these targets are great. And there have been consistent delays by the government in creating an evaluation framework for a $5.1 billion strategy. So what I wanted to ask you, Nikki, is what do you think this means for the federal government's current trajectory of creating effective policy in the bureaucratic sense in delivering funding?
Look, this might seem very simple, but to pick up on, I guess, the theme that I've been talking about, which is around self-determination and Indigenous nationhood, right? The very simple adage, listen to what Indigenous people say, do that, doesn't apply in the Indigenous Advancement Scheme, right?
Mm.
And so, and I must say, though, that you do see this throughout the course of Australian history, or at least since the creation of the Department of Aboriginal Affairs after the referendum, right? You see this process whereby Indigenous affairs are brought into DPMC and then farmed back out to the departments, and then they're kind of brought back in as machinery of government changes. There's all sorts of kind of bureaucratic changes that happen to Indigenous affairs. Sometimes it's a central agency right in with Treasury and PMC. Sometimes it's out in the wilds with, you know, with everyone else. And so these are political changes that, again, serve a purpose, right? Like these are sometimes money-saving endeavours, and I would suggest that a large part of what Tony Abbott did with the Indigenous Advancement Scheme was to cut budgets. It was a half a billion dollars cut from Indigenous affairs in Australia when those changes were made. People lost their jobs, services were defunded, communities that had funding agreements in place for years suddenly found themselves having to compete under brand new categories for things that weren't even covered. Universities, for example, had to reapply for funding to support Indigenous students in categories that never existed before. Do you know, and it's one thing to ask Melbourne University to prepare a funding application, but it's quite a different matter to ask a community-based childcare organisation to complete a brand new funding application in a brand new category for competitive funding that it might not get, where it had been funded for many years to do a very good job beforehand. And so what these bureaucratic changes do is that they destabilise. And they destabilise in a way that is often a really long way away from how people understand the function of bureaucracy and politics. Say in Canberra, right, they destabilise people's jobs. You don't know if you're going to have a job at the end of the contract. You don't know if you're going to get funding again. What do you do with that program that all those kids turn up to after school? How do we know if Uncle's going to be employed in that ranger program to do that caring for country business? You know, so what might seem like cost cutting or efficiency or these changes that we see over time about being bought into PM&C and being bought out actually have profound implications for families and communities, for their job certainty. Because what it does is it says that the government is not convinced that these are essential services and that the best way to determine what is an essential service is to get people to compete for funding. Mm. And is that the determination that we really want to make?
Nope.
The funding goes to the people who can put together the slickest funding application and that's how we determine need?
Yeah.
I don't think so, right? And so the impact on the people in the federal government departments who lost their jobs was huge. You know, the changes to the process was huge. It was an appalling process that, as you say, and the audit office is, you know, roundly deemed as an absolute disaster. Mm. But I also want us to keep kind of coming back to what the implications of those bureaucratic changes are for people who depend on this kind of funding for delivering incredibly important services and programs that are often the glue keeping families and communities together. And that's why we have these kinds of programs, right?
Mm. Yeah. I cannot highlight enough the importance of small Indigenous communities that rely on these services provided by them and being out there and seeing the work that is done on the front lines by Indigenous workers and non-Indigenous workers to make sure that these communities are brought up to par with just the necessities is, in my mind, basically mind-blowing.
Or, God forbid, the kinds of things that those communities are important.
Yeah.
You know, maybe one community wants to have particular types of art programs. Maybe another community needs some after-school programs, you know, and being able to have the power to decide what your community needs and to fund it is not a revolutionary idea.
No.
Right? That's not out of the box. And I think sometimes, you know, as political scientists, as sociologists, as people who are really passionate about these kinds of issues, we treat these bureaucratic changes as an intellectual matter. And I think it's really important that we do exactly what you say to kind of come back to understand that these have real impacts on people's lives.
Yeah. And, also to re-highlight your point that sometimes people at the top in bureaucracy and government, they don't see the profound effect that it will have on people if they lose their job, or because sometimes to them it's just statistic. It's just a program. When, as you say, like a after-school program, we all have in one time or another been in an after-school program because our parents are finishing work and they can't come to pick us up on time. And that, like, vital importance of still being cared for is and still enjoying yourself and having somewhere to go at least and feeling safe and protected.
I think you're right. I think there's, you know, and there's often a really important thing to recognize that the kinds of programs that get funded, like it might be an after-school program, right? But actually what that's doing is facilitating connections between elders and communities. And you don't put that in a funding application, right? Like you try and write your funding application to meet the aims and objectives of the funding program. But actually in practice, what it's doing is all of these other incredibly important things that never see the light of day, that don't get put in the funding application, that don't get put in the media release, but are so integral to the good functioning of people's lives, that create connections, that create spaces, that do all these other things. And I think when we have a particular approach to public management, what we miss out is the possibilities that are created by having these programs. This is not a technical exercise. This is about how we support the very fabric of people's lives.
Before you said that you were touching on a theme throughout the episodes, and we would like just to primarily focus on that theme in terms of adding voice and recognition and giving the power to determine some policies in a variety of areas for Indigenous people by Indigenous people. And so we'd like to just primarily finish up the episode discussing the Uluru Statement from the Heart and moving towards treaty and voice and constitutional recognition. And that's something you're following and that there's significant changes going on. I would like just to discuss that because it's I believe it's very important, especially for our listeners, just to understand where we can move to from here. There are also some myths around it and also facts that need to be set straight because it's vitally important that people know so that when we engage in this discussion, it's effective discussion and that we can move towards it calmly and cleanly as in a utopian world, if I have to say it correctly.
Let's do it.
Let's primarily discuss where to from here. And we would love your academic knowledge.
Here for it, Jared.
And yeah, please go on with... Well, the first question is, the Uluru Statement from the Heart, released in 2017, was by far one of a major step in terms of getting the government to try and recognise and add a voice to our constitution. And some people may actually not know what the Uluru Statement from the Heart, and if they do, what the primary focus of it was and how the government received it. So if are you able to elaborate on that for us a little bit?
It was an incredible process. And look, I'm by far not the biggest expert on the Uluru Statement or the deliberative process that led up to it, or I'm certainly not a constitutional expert by any stretch of the imagination. So I will do my best.
Yeah. It's a phenomenal document.
It is.
And the language is beautiful, and I cannot stress that enough.
Well, it is incredible, right? Because what it signifies is a coming together of all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander nations across the country who came together to produce this statement. It says that this is what we want, you know, and I think that there are always assumptions that all Indigenous people need to agree on everything, otherwise we can't possibly go ahead, right? It's just another excuse to not do anything, right? So there were some dissenting voices, and those voices say important things, right? One of the most interesting things about the Uluru Statement is that it's largely a consensus position. So when you read the text of it, you can see that what it's calling for is a say over our own lives. But it's done in such a way that it has got incredibly widespread support amongst a huge part of the community. So all of the mining companies and all of the big four banks have endorsed the Uluru Statement. And that's quite remarkable, you know what I mean? Like, to have a statement being issued to the Australian people. And I think Megan Davis is, you know, quite brilliant, you know, when she talks about how the delegates, the delegation, the process of coming up with the Uluru Statement wasn't to speak to government. It was to speak directly to the Australian people and to say that this is what we think is going to work. The Uluru Statement itself is most definitely not a radical position, right? Like, I can come on this podcast and I can talk about Indigenous nationhood and devolving functions of state. And I'm like, yeah, absolutely. Pay the rent. Like, get amongst it, right? Because I can do that, yes? But the Uluru Statement and the work that Megan Davis did, it's brilliant. Mm. Lies in the fact that it is absolutely a middle ground consensus statement that is more like smack bang in the middle of the path of the way forward than anything I could have ever imagined for this country. It has been charted with the kind of consensus from the Aboriginal community that I can't imagine a comparison for, and has come up with a system that is so eminently workable. I think that the critique that has come forward on the Uluru Statement largely comes from people who either don't understand it or who have particular opinions about the place of Indigenous people in the Australian state. And that's what really this comes down to. When people talk about a third chamber of parliament.
I was going to say
right.
Barnaby Barnaby Joyce back when the Uluru Statement was released, as well as Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull, the Indigenous Affairs Minister Nigel Scullion, all disagreed with the Uluru Statement, which I found profoundly offensive, as well as the communities that put effort into it.
Well, the thing about that is also that it's actually kind of a little bit old hat too. Mm. If you ever wanted to engage in a little bit of historical archival work, I would really encourage you to go back to the objections that Australia lodged to the passing of the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People. So when that was first passed by the United Nations, four countries voted against it: Australia, New Zealand, Canada, and the United States.
Oh!
It was later ratified by Australia.
Hmm.
When Kevin Rudd came to power. But when Australia said, no, we're not voting for that, it lodged a series of demands that are recorded in the United Nations debates of the day. And these are the particular kinds of narratives that get wheeled out. This idea of special consideration, that we would no more treat one quote-unquote race of people different from any other quote-unquote race of people, that Indigenous peoples need to be treated the same, that we have this kind of blanket approach to treating all citizens equally, and there is no room for different legal systems, so on and so forth, which are profoundly untrue on any level, right? But it comes down to this idea about whether or not you agree that Indigenous peoples were here first, and by virtue of that fact, enjoy specific rights.
So I wanted to talk about three key elements that were set out in the Uluru Statement, and precisely only one of them involves an actual change to the Australian Constitution, mm-hmm. which would kind of spur on the idea of a third chamber, which was latched onto. I will say, though, Barnaby Joyce has changed his opinion since then, but take that with a grain of salt as you will. It is
opinions can change back, can't
they? Yes, they definitely can. So I just wanted to outline the three. So the constitutional change, and this is outlined on the Uluru Statement website, so I'm not making these up. The constitutional change involves enshrining a First Nations voice in the Australian Constitution that would empower Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people.
Mm-hmm.
The legislative change involves the establishment of a Makarrata Commission, which would supervise a process of agreement making with Australian government.
Mm-hmm.
And the third would be the Makarrata Commission itself, which would oversee a process of truth-telling about Australia's history and colonialisation. Now, with those three elements, are we able to kind of break them down to dispel any possible dissidence that people might have with that?
Yeah, absolutely.
Because a lot of people sometimes don't have an understanding.
They're really complex ideas, yeah. You know what I mean? And having the words voice, treaty, truth is an incredibly accessible catchphrase, right? Mm. Remember that, voice, treaty, truth.
It's like Kevin 07. It's got stuck in my head.
Oh, it's looks stuck, all right. It's absolutely stuck.
Help.
Please. So we're going to break this down.
Yep.
Yeah, the first part is around a voice to Parliament.
Yep.
And that says what we need to do is we need to get a majority of people in a majority of states to agree to change the constitution that says that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in Australia have a say over legislation. My understanding of it is that that's not a veto right over legislation. It doesn't say that you can't do that. It doesn't say, oh, but we need more funding. It doesn't say, oh, yes, but you can't do that there. It just says Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people have an interest in the things that happen in Australia because it was our country before it was yours, right?
Yes.
And still is Aboriginal land. And because it always was and always will be Aboriginal land, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people are going to be forever interested, and I use interested in all theoretical and common senses of the word, in the things that happen here.
Hmm.
And is it so radical to suggest that any piece of legislation can just have a covering report, an appendix, an advisory document that says that this is what Indigenous people think about this piece of legislation?
Yeah.
I think it is. I think it's not. I think that what it says by enshrining that in the Constitution is that this is actually beyond politics, that there is a process of seeking justice, that there is a process of seeking recognition that forever Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people have been here and Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people will always be here. Our stories will always be in the land. Our families will always be here. And that means that we're always going to care about the stuff that happens here. And to have a say, to be able to say to Parliament, here is some Indigenous perspectives on that, this legislation.
Yeah, on that health policy.
On that legislation, on that environmental policy. Yeah, on that carbon price.
Mm.
On that bushfire preparedness legislation. Yeah?
Mm.
On how we treat mothers and children, right? To have an Indigenous perspective on the matters that govern our nation, I think can only lead to better outcomes for all of us. Because in case you haven't noticed lately, we're in a bit of a state.
Yeah.
It's a time, right?
Mm.
And we desperately need a circuit breaker in Australian politics, and that circuit breaker has to be Indigenous perspectives.
And we talked about it in the last episode briefly, ATSIC, or the
Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Commission.
I literally just had a mind blank. I'm so sorry.
It's a lot of acronyms in this space. It is a lot of acronym.
And one of the things that I had about constitutional recognition is that ATSIC was created through legislation, but just as easily it was abolished through legislation.
John Howard said in his first ever press conference that he did when he first came to power that he was going to get rid of ATSIC.
And that basically limited Indigenous Australia's voice in policy in a major way. And that's probably how we come to the state that we are in now.
And every other body that has been established, the Council for Aboriginal Recognition, the National Congress of Australia's First People, all of these bodies which are either statutory or which are funded through the Indigenous Advancement Scheme or through other limited funding agreements, that funding can be pulled, that legislation can be retracted, can be overturned. If it's not in the Constitution, it doesn't mean anything.
Yeah. So do you, in a yes or no question, do you believe that if Indigenous voices are enshrined in the Constitution, that we will not have to face that situation of ATSIC once again, where our government couldn't come by and just say, we want to get rid of that kind of stakeholder?
Look, and I think that my understanding of the Uluru Statement and the voice to Parliament might be a little limited, but my sense of it at the moment is that the voice to Parliament is literally just a voice.
Yeah.
It just says, here is Indigenous people's perspective on X topic. I don't think there is any suggestion that the government has to take that advice.
Mm.
Right? And so it's very much a voice to Parliament. It's not an edict, an authority. It's not there's no requirement
or
to
quid pro quo
listen to the things that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people say.
Mm.
Right? And so I think that you can enshrine the voice. It might be a separate department. It might be, there might be another process. Who knows what it might look like. But it's definitely not a chamber of parliament.
Yeah, definitely.
At most, it might be like an advisory office.
Mm.
And so the thing about advice is that you can listen to it or not, right? So I think then we then get into what is the nature of political reforms. Would our nation, I think, be as a whole better for it? Yes, absolutely. Is it the end of the story? No, it's not. And I think that's why having other processes, a Makarrata Commission, process of treaty making and a process of truth telling, I think are really important parts of the Uluru Statement, so that this problem that we get into with the overturning of statutory bodies and the overturning of legislation becomes much more difficult when you're talking about treaties, nation-to-nation treaties, and when you're talking about constitutional processes.
And just to wrap up the episode, and basically this is going to sound like I'm asking a same question, but this is kind of at the Commonwealth and states level, because recently the Northern Territory and Victoria have made headway in treaty circumstances, establishing treaty. So for just our listeners, moving forward, how do you believe that we can engage with treaty and how we can, rather than be reactive, maybe proactive in our stances to getting treaty done, and where you believe we'll go to from here in terms of policy.
Yeah, absolutely. And in Queensland, there's been a past treaty process. Mm. South Australia, it was on the table before the current government kind of took it off. So these conversations are actually starting to happen in really meaningful ways, I think, around Australia in a way that might actually be a treaty, right? Now, if we can take lessons from New Zealand and North America, it's that often you have to take the government to court to get them to deliver on their treaty promises, right? You kind of have to make a treaty, the colonial state violates the treaty, you have to sue for that violation or for some other kind of settlement process in order to determine how you're going to meet the criteria of the treaty. So I think that there are really profound questions for Indigenous people in terms of how we organise ourselves politically. I think that the native title process has been incredibly complicated around Australia, and it's had a process of boundary making, of, you know, centering the expertise of anthropologists and you know, kind of white historians, as opposed to how communities understand themselves. And this really kind of goes to the heart of what it means for Indigenous political organisation to exist separately from constitution by the state. So I think that really fundamental steps forward need to be taken by non-Indigenous people to understand what Indigenous treaty making involves. What is it? How does it work? Where do we see other examples of it? What's in a treaty, what's not? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So there's almost like a process that we all need to go through of preparing ourselves to come to the table. Does that make sense?
That makes sense, yeah.
So I think that in many ways, Indigenous people have been waiting at a table for a really long time for non-Indigenous people to come down and sit down and talk to us. We've been here. We know the conversations that we want to have. We've been waiting for someone to listen. And so I think that the conversations are hopefully shifting, and that if non-Indigenous people can do that work of preparing themselves, educating themselves, informing themselves to come to the table, that the conversation can actually finally be a meaningful one. And I think a treaty processes, you know, necessarily involve truth and reconciliation commissions and healing and thinking about what does it mean to be a post-conflict society that is interested in social justice. And I think that all of these mechanisms, lessons from other parts of the world, I think they're all available to us. It's just a matter of listening and coming to the table to have those conversations.
Thank you so much, Nikki.
Absolute pleasure.
We cannot tell you how happy we are to have you in the studio with us today.
I am so thrilled to be asked. You would be surprised at how often a lot of people say they're interested in Indigenous stuff, right? But to actually kind of have a really long conversation about it, to think about the kinds of things that you want to learn about, listen to, read, think about, you know, is really important, and I can only encourage everyone to get amongst it.
On that, Nikki, as a beautiful scholar and academic, do you have and you probably do have a wide variety of recommendations for books, articles,
so many
/ films, top three, let's go top
oh
three.
My god, top three, you know, I'm gonna give you more than three. I'm just gonna, I know you said three.
Yeah,
I'm just gonna ignore that, Jared.
All right, don't worry,
I'm gonna say a bunch of other things.
Oh, okay, ouch.
One of my favorite reads at the moment is Inferior by Angela Saini, and it is an incredible book that charts the history of race science and the role of Australia and the settler colonial government's treatment of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander in the very development of what we think of when we say the word race.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think Angela Saini makes this incredible point that race is the child of racism, not the other way around. Racism came first and then came the idea of race. And it's just an incredible book. Everyone should read it. In Indigenous affairs, I think that it's really important that we start telling the story about what it means to be on Aboriginal land. And I think that everyone needs to read Dark Emu and Convincing Ground by Bruce Pascoe.
Yep.
And everyone needs to read The Biggest Estate on Earth by Bill Gammage. Those three books together, oh my God, amazing.
Fantastic.
So good. In terms of policy and politics, one of my favourite reads at the moment is Neoliberal Indigenous Policy by Liz Strakosch. It's fantastic. She's so smart. Oh my gosh, she can just like crush things with her mind. She's amazing. Rebuilding Native Nations by Miriam Jorgensen is a little bit older now, but it's a wonderful collection. And yeah, I think that they're incredibly important. I mean, there are so many Indigenous authors.
Definitely.
You know, Melissa Lukashenko, Claire Coleman, you know, oh my God, there's people doing amazing things. But I think if you're at the beginning of learning about race, racism, Indigenous history, then I think that those books by Angela Saini, Bruce Pascoe, Bill Gammage, Miriam Jorgensen, Liz Strakosch are like the best place to start. You can just come and enroll in some of my subjects.
I'll do that. I've actually had the pleasure of being tutored by Nikki, and it was phenomenal, an absolute fantastic class. And anyone who has any aspirations to learn about Indigenous policy, and I highly recommend you do, definitely always look to Nikki.
It's a rock and roll class,
it's
Jared.
I had a great time every time. It was sometimes very sad, but sometimes very enlightening at the same time. So.
This is agonism, yeah. Right? This is recognizing that conflict and complexity and emotional work is a part of everyday lives, and that's how we take politics forward. Yeah.
But once again, thank you so much, Nikki.
Thanks so much for the invite, guys.
Every time I like talk about policy, it's always Nikki's always somewhere in there, gotta say.
Booyah.
Booyah.
All right. Thank you, Policy Heads, for tuning in with us today. Hope that you stay tuned for our next episode. We'll see you next time.
Beautiful.
See ya. Right.
Bye. Bye.